of the program. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our Working Group Chair, Senior Fellow for the Economic Policy and Director of the Center for Universal Education Council on Foreign Relations, the Honorable Gene Sperling.
Thank you so much. I'm going to be brief because we have a fantastic panel. We had one bit of unfortunate news, which is Beatrice Weary from Uganda, who's one of the leading forces for AIDS and for education and as a both as a social vaccine against AIDS and for dealing with children who are affected by it, will be here, but a little too late for this panel. Her flight was canceled. We are very, very lucky to have two terrific replacements. I guess she took two to replace. I'm going to let our moderator go through, but I really appreciate the power of this panel. I do want to say just very quickly that when we were sitting around and thinking what would make us unhappy with an education session, it would be that if at the end we had somehow ignored the special strategies for children who are doubly, triply disadvantaged and are too far often ignored. And so the way we decided that wasn't going to happen was that we were going to do a special panel on it. And then when you're doing these things, you always have your kind of dream first choice. I can say that every single dream first choice I had for the whole Clayton Global Initiative came through, but this is a case where it did for our moderator. Anybody who has watched Anderson Cooper as an anchor on CNN, and the specials he's done even for the Oprah Winfrey Show, for other things, knows that he brings a very special sensitivity and leaps into, with great care and sensitivity, some of the most difficult issues on genocide, on refugees, on Africa. And when you've seen that, all I could feel was I wish that we could get him to come moderate and bring his sense to the most difficult challenges in developing countries in education. And so with that, I just want to thank him so much for agreeing to do this and our four great panelists. I'm going to turn it over to Anderson Cooper. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm told Shakira was here before, which is a tough act to follow, so there will be no dancing on stage right now. First of all, what the topic is, the promise of a free universal education means little for literally hundreds of millions of kids around the world who are too often left behind, and they're the kids we're here to talk about today. We're talking about girls who live in remote areas far away from schools, child laborers, those with disabilities, victims of sex trafficking, and kids who are orphaned or affected by HIV/AIDS. These are kids for whom school is a dream. It's impossible to reach because of a variety of reasons: school fees, the need to supplement their family's income, discrimination, long distances to the schools, and educational facilities that simply can't accommodate or won't accommodate their disabilities. So the question that we're trying to figure out today is how to reach these kids, how to reach the most vulnerable children among us. And again, we're talking about hundreds of millions of children, the estimates of at least 100 million street children around the world. So it's huge numbers of kids here. The adjectives, what we need are innovative, creative, and ambitious solutions, and certainly all those adjectives apply to all the people on the stage here today. I just want to introduce briefly Judith Heumann on the end, is with the D.C. Department of Disability Services. For more than 30 years, she's been an internationally recognized expert on disability and diversity issues. She's named as the World Bank's first advisor on disability and development. Indrajit Kurane started the Ruchika School Service Social Service Organization. She created railway platform schools for hundreds of thousands of kids in India who work on the trains or on the railways. Right now, her organization runs 12 of these platform schools, 75 slum schools, 20 nursery schools, preventative HIV projects, two schools on wheels, vocational training, as well as water and sanitation projects in slums. Her contributions are truly remarkable. Stephen Lewis was the UN Special Envoy for HIV/AIDS in Africa. He's now the co-director of AIDS Free World, an international AIDS organization, advocacy organization. And Gary Nell, right next to me, is CEO of Sesame Workshop. Sesame Street is now seen in 120 countries around the world, and they're going to be moving into Nigeria based on pledges that were made last year here at the Clinton Global Initiative. So that's the panel. The question, I guess, is getting to these kids who are most in need. Judith, in terms of kids with disabilities, I read a statistic that is truly just astounding. Only 2% of disabled children in developing countries actually receive an education. That cannot be true.
Well, unfortunately, it is true, and the figures go between 2 and 10%. So let's say 10% of the kids receive an education. I think there are some very big stigmas that face disabled children, and also a significant lack of understanding about who the population is. And some of the solutions that would enable disabled children to go to school really directly have to be addressed by helping people understand that disabled children can benefit from education just like any other population. And I think that's really one of the biggest barriers, that in many cases people look at disabled children as being God's children and we need to protect the population, but we don't see the value of education. So we're seeing some good progress that's going on in countries around the world. And I think in part what's necessary is the organization of disability organizations, the organizing of parents, so that parents themselves can become influencers in the local communities.
But don't a lot of schools just say, look, we don't have the money for special facilities, or we don't have the training to incorporate a child with a disability, whether it's a physical disability or otherwise, into the classroom?
But in many cases, there's nothing that needs to be done. I mean, in the United States, I didn't get to go to school until I was 9 years old. I didn't need any accommodations except a ramp into the school. And there are millions of children around the world who had polio, have other types of disabilities where we just need a little bit of access into the school. And then there are other children who do need teachers who have better training. But in reality, when we look at the dropouts in school, which is a very high percentage in many countries, one of the causes of children dropping out of school is invisible disabilities, learning disabilities, mild to moderate intellectual disabilities, mental health disabilities. So I think it's very important that we are looking at ways of ensuring that teachers, even in the poorest areas, are able to get some very basic training on what needs to be done to identify kids who are having difficulty and getting supports for them.
Is there someplace where it's working now, where there, in the developing world, that you can point to as a success story?
I think in many, many countries, in Ethiopia, there's some very good work going on, in Uganda, in South Africa, in Pakistan, in India, in a number of countries in Latin America. There are national laws in some cases, local laws, commitments that have been made, financing that's coming in from the private sector, financing that's coming in from organizations like the World Bank and others, and donor aid from countries like Norway and Finland. There are a lot of very interesting projects that are going on that are being proven to be quite successful. I have this little book that you told me to show, and I'll have it for you to look at, but it was done in Pakistan. It was written by children, disabled and non-disabled, between the ages of 12 and 17. And the name of the book is Just Like the Other Kids, and it's for elementary school children. This may seem very basic, but it's basically a book which enables people to begin to not be afraid of disabled people. I think in many countries, the stigma around disability is very significant, and people believe that disability is the result of something bad that families did. So it's a complex issue.
And Gary, in terms of what Sesame Street is doing, breaking stigmas is something in South Africa, for instance, you guys are doing with Muppets.
It is, Anderson. I want to put in a shameless plug, by the way. We do have a special celebrity on Sesame Street this season, Anderson Cooper, as part of GNN, the Grouch News Network. So,
some of my finest work, actually.
In South Africa, as many of you know, 1 in 9 children are infected by HIV and AIDS. And we felt that we could make a contribution through our South African adaptation of Sesame Street, Takalani Sesame, by introducing an HIV-positive Muppet character named Cammy, who has become a regular cast member of the show. And maybe similar to how we have develop characters in this country and others with physical disabilities who become regular cast members, we're able to deal with stigma, Anderson, in a way where children learn that they can be friends with someone and play with them and not necessarily get sick, because there is so much mythology that surrounds the virus, even among the youngest of children. in southern Africa. So she has become really a role model. She's become a UNICEF champion for children. President Mandela has had her out in front of thousands of children at his annual Christmas event, which he's been doing for many years. And in that way, we're able to use the power of media, which children are naturally attracted to, and television and radio in this case, to try to influence them and destigmatize children who have been shunted in many ways by their peers.
And Stephen, it's not in Africa, around the world, it's not just the stigma of HIV/AIDS which keeps kids out of school or limits kids' educational abilities. I mean, literally, AIDS is decimating the teacher population in many of these countries. In Zambia, I read 40% of the teacher population is HIV positive, and they are dying off at greater rates than they are graduating new teachers.
In fact, that's something that Zambia has been coping with desperately over the last few years, because the number of teachers is so profoundly depleted. And when you have reduced numbers of teachers and you have very large class sizes and you're trying to maintain some substance and quality of education, it's a very tough slog. But on top of that, of course, when you're dealing with HIV and AIDS kids, you're dealing with children who have lost their parents very often. There are now 14, 15 million orphan children orphaned by AIDS in sub-Saharan Africa. The numbers are rising exponentially, and they're traumatized. For them, it is so inexplicable and bewildering, this sudden and abrupt loss of the parents, and they're desperately in need of nurture and support, and that's very difficult to find. We all use the facile phrase psychosocial support, but there are no psychologists, there are no social workers. You're dependent on the sensitivities of the community and of the teachers, and it isn't always there. And for these kids, it's incredibly hard, and it's often hard even to get to schools, because so many schools are not accessible because of the fees. Many countries haven't abolished school fees at primary level.
In terms of how you get school to the most vulnerable, Inderjeet, you literally brought the schools to the most vulnerable with the train platform schools. Talk a little bit about how that works.
It's on, okay, it's on. I noticed when I moved to Bhubaneswar, which is the capital of the poorest state in India, that a lot of children were out of school. About 35,000 children are still out of school. And this came to my notice when I started a formal school with two children, and I had 20 children outside my gate from the neighboring slums. When I visited the station, I found children in the age group 8 to 14 who were their own minders, earners, and they just did everything that an adult would do without any adult role models. Their role models were the policemen and the gangsters. And, I made a silent commitment that if it is a return to childhood that the child needs, then I would take a childhood back to the child. He's a child. As we know that officially till 14 he's still a child. And I wanted to return a happy childhood to the child, an unadulterated, joyful childhood, happiness and laughter and fun. And education was included in the program. It was not my primary focus. But it was the children, I must tell you, that children who we save from the poorer sections of society are not interested in education, nor are the parents. That's not true. Because the children came, 11 on the first day, and within 2 months, 114 on the railway station. And, we had a class full of fun, so much so that the railway station authorities could not function anymore. They were all out to watch us. And finally, the superintendent had to ask me if I would leave the station, which fortunately for me didn't really become a big threat, because I know no barriers. reaching out to children, I said there will be no barriers. I'll skirt the barriers anyhow. And we've skirted them, and we now have 17 platform schools.
And in terms of, I'm sure it's been a process trying to figure out what works and what doesn't work in terms of reaching these children. What did not work, and what does work most effectively?
What has worked with has been following the needs of the children. Very often, the children have dictated to me what they wanted. They have suggested ideas and methodologies. Because, for instance, there was this child in the first week in school who said, "What are you trying to teach me?" So I said, "I'm trying to teach you how to read and write." He said, "But I already know how to write, and I can write in 3 languages. And he wrote down 3 words, and those words are in Oriya, Hindi, and English, and they were the name of a picture hoarding, a film hoarding. And he said, "I can teach myself to write from this, so you don't have to really teach me." So we adopted that idea, and we had flashcards and picture cards to teach them writing, to teach them reading, which is so important. They knew mathematics. They could do sums, multiplication and division and what have you, all the tricks of the trade, just mentally, but they couldn't write them down, so we taught them to do that. So we just followed the child's needs. They wanted to read storybooks. We helped them to read storybooks, learn poems. And in fact, this little boy grew up to be a teenager who would sit at the Wheeler's cabin at the railway station. And Wheeler's cabin, you know, houses books. And he would read all the books on general knowledge. And when I went to the station, he would question me. I was his favorite target. And he would say, "Whoever made you the principal? You don't know anything." So he was learning so much more than me.
Uh-huh. I want to ask on the panel what you think. There's a program in Brazil, there's a similar program in Mexico, that actually funds or gives a stipend to families to send their children to school. It's often done on a monthly basis. There's a credit card in some of these programs that the mothers can check as long as the kids have perfect attendance or near perfect attendance. Is that a solution?
I think that's a very good solution, but unfortunately you need that kind of financing. It's a lot of financing, but it's a very good...
In Brazil, I think it's $6 a month per family.
Yes.
Is roughly the cost.
That, in fact, is a lot of money when people are living on less than a dollar a day, and it makes great sense if the government or the state can provide that kind of support to vulnerable families and orphan children.
Which is what's happened in Mexico. There's a lot of government support, but in other places there hasn't been.
What's important is that the government has a policy which says all children are included. Because sometimes you've seen in these programs where disabled kids might not go to school, the families may not send them. So in countries like Uganda where they had a policy like that, disabled kids were explicitly included.
I should mention Mexico has done a wonderful job, and I think Dr. Julio Frank is here, who used to be the Minister of Health, and now at the Gates Foundation. And he not only did a lot in getting this program out there, but built in content which was indigenous to the native groups in southern Mexico out of San Cristobal de las Casas that included some of our materials to deal with health issues, including sort of this bizarre issue of obesity and undernourishment at the same time. So we've been able to use media in the classrooms to try to inspire the kids to stay.
But let's make it clear that for many of these governments, the dollars, the resources simply aren't available. It's a tremendous burden, and there has to be support from the international community. There just must. After all, for many of the primary schools in Africa and governments in Africa, they didn't have school fees before. These school fees came courtesy of the international financial institutions, courtesy of the World Bank and the IMF during the days of structural adjustment. There's an argument, therefore, to be made that the organizations which effectively imposed the condition called user fees on school children down the road, that they should help to compensate governments as they attempt to remove the fees. And by the way, there are no secondary schools that are free. And the gender inequalities become massive at secondary school. In sub-Saharan Africa, of all the kids in secondary school, 14% are girls. So that gender inequality lies at the heart of what we have to
do. And talk a little bit about the importance of educating young girls. I mean, the impact that a girl's education can have reverberates not only throughout the entire family, but a community.
Yes, and everybody agrees that it is the strongest fortress against poverty, and it allows for the embrace of health and the presence in the community and the knowledge of how to bring up children and all of the things that are denied so many young girls. Because
so how do you overcome that? How do you overcome what is in some cases a cultural prohibition or a religious prohibition? How do you make those strides?
Well, you fight like the devil for the principle of gender equality. And when the United Nations has before it a proposition, as it does, to create the first ever international women's agency, then all the other agencies and all the governments of the world should get behind it, because you would finally have a daily voice for women and girls the way you have UNICEF now for children generally. And that's been missing in the international community. We've never had a force for women on a continuing basis. It's one of the most abysmal dimensions of multilateralism.
We have found two strategies which work very well with girls, because I concentrate a lot on girls getting some kind of education. And I allow the siblings to come to school. So the childminder and the housekeeper comes to school with the little sibling, and we look after the sibling and get the child to study. And children have found strategies. They'll stretch their legs and put the babies there and right by the side, or read over the baby's head while the baby is sleeping. And if the child is playing, then we have toys in the school which the child plays with.
I think getting back to the issue of disabled children for a minute, and how many of the disabled kids don't have visible disabilities. There was a longitudinal study that was done in the United States in the 1990s. Which showed that disabled teenage girls by the age of 18 were twice as likely to be single mothers as non-disabled kids. That's an international figure I'm sure that we would see over and over again. And these young women, many of whom have mild to moderate intellectual disabilities and mental health disabilities, are at great risk of sexually transmitted diseases and HIV/AIDS, etc. These are children also who, even in that quote-unquote developed countries, have very high dropout rates. So we really haven't looked at the comprehensive needs of this population of individuals. And just like the information that research on girls, we see that when girls go to school, you see a reduction in pregnancy rates, et cetera, et cetera. It's the same thing that would happen in this area.
We girls' education also takes role modeling, and it's very important because so many cultures, not all of the ones that Stephen, you've been working in, but many cultures like Egypt are hugely impacted by media, by television. It's the leading exporter of television movie content throughout the Arab world. We have a young girl role model on our show in Egypt, on Alam Simsim. And Mrs. Mubarak has embraced her as a role model for young girls and has used her as to catapult really an entire girls' empowerment program where 60% of the female population is illiterate, and it's been a very powerful engine. You've got to start, in our view, at the new generation to begin to, you know, have a little bit more of a slate that's clean to begin to build new role models for young girls so they are looking at themselves with a future and a horizon that is positive, which their mothers and maybe even older sisters have not had.
Do you know, if I may, Anderson, there's also a strong movement in some of the African countries, I think of Zambia as an example, to make the school the center of the community. So it's not just an educational vehicle, but it provides health services, it provides social welfare payments, it becomes the center for food if kids can get one meal a day. It actually is the central piece of the community structure, and it makes of education a much more formidable impact.
Actually, the social service wing, Guruchika Social Service Wing, is doing exactly that. We have the community meetings in the school room that we have created along with the community. The community has helped us to build the room, as well as bathrooms and potable water devices.
So, Indrajit, what do you say to a family who says, well, look, I can't send my child to your school because he or she needs to work?
You know, we have flexi timings. So we have a lot of rag pickers who go out from the slums. They leave at around 4 in the morning and return by about 7. And they have whatever leftover dinner is usually watered rice. So they have some of that watered rice, and then they come to school.
At night?
At 9 they come to school. Well, they are late because the school starts at 7, but we allow them to come at 9. For children who are boarding trains, we get their copies and books ready. They can do the work in the school itself, or they can carry a worksheet in the train. And very often, from Bhubaneswar to Calcutta, you will find children working on these worksheets in the train itself. And some of them come back to show us how well they've done, but some of them, of course, lose their papers. But they do come. And the wonderful part of the children who are on the trains is that if they don't come for about 15 days, there's a relay machine amongst the children on the trains who tell us where the child would be. Is he in Calcutta? Or is he hurt and in the hospital? Or is he in Bombay? So we get news of the child and we try to trace them through Childline, which is another line that we have an emergency service for children, whereby we contact Childline in 76 other cities, and we are able to get news about the child back to us through the Childline service. So, you know, there are one has to look at, if you really want to educate the children, you have to look at newer and newer strategies. Some work, some don't, but more often they work than not.
I just want to ask this question to each of you before we take a break and allow people to talk at the tables. Judith, what are you hoping comes out of this today? I mean, what do you want people to take away from this room right now?
That any people that are doing work in the education look at whether or not disabled children are being included, and if they're being included meaningfully. And if not, that they look at the countries that they're working in, identify the local parent groups and disability groups to learn how they can do that.
Indrajit, how about for you?
I would like to have people think about children who are the have-nots in our society. And where do we have the largest number of have-nots? You know, 35 million children don't go to school, don't ever see a school. Besides health, disease, and, you know, problems which are, you know, so common amongst the children, these are some of the problems that the world must look at. I think this global conference must look at the world per se. I'm not asking for very much. We have 332 slums in Bhubaneswar and 740 stations. Can we look at help for those children, all those who live around the stations, travel on the trains, and live in the slums? That's it. I'm local. I'm not going to the other districts. I'm not spreading all over India because I want to set an example of an undiluted program.
How much does your organization spend each year?
This year we have reached 1 crore. I don't know how many millions that would be.
$200,000.
$200,000.
And you reach how many children?
And we reach 5,000 children. We've just covered the entire gamut of services which we can offer to children. We have helpline for girls. We have childline for boys and girls up to 14. Helpline for children, girls above 14. We have an HIV AIDS awareness program for adolescents who live on the station because they have such open exposure and plenty of exposure to sex. So we have a program for them. We have also have a program for health. We are reaching out with 2 mobile vans to all the schools that we run twice a week. We have a toy library which takes toys to the children once a week to every school so that The children can enjoy handling and playing with toys, which they only look at in shop windows.
Mm. Stephen, how about for you? What should people take away?
I'm overwhelmed by what Inderjita is accomplishing with relatively small amounts of money. I just hope that we all collectively understand that there are millions upon millions of children now in the world, particularly in sub-Saharan Africa, but beyond, who have lost their parents as a result of a virus. The numbers are increasing in places exponentially. They're deeply emotionally wounded and scarred. They are bewildered by what's happened to them. They're frequently living with their grandmothers who have buried their own adult children and begin to parent again when they're 50 and 60 and 70 years of age. They are living in child-headed households when the grandmother dies, and they're desperate for school. The yearning for a school is so intense, it's positively palpable. And they are deprived of that school because they can't afford the fees or the uniforms or the textbooks or the parent-teacher association fees or the examination fees, the whole panoply of things which stand in the way. And it can all be overcome with some real sense of resources. They're there. Gordon Brown, Prime Minister of the UK, came to the United Nations on July 31st, and correct me, David, if I'm wrong, but I think he said $9 billion a year would do it to put every kid in school, disabilities, disadvantage, right across the board. And you'll forgive me as a $10 billion. You'll forgive me as a Canadian, a faintly invidious comment, but since my own country is involved, I can make it. We're now spending between $10 and $15 billion a month to fight wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we cannot seem to summon that amount of money in 1 year to put all of the children into school. And that seems to me to be the loss of a moral anchor internationally.
Gary?
Design a strategy to break the political stalemate on getting resources to children. And my own suggestion is, because I'm a believer in pillow talk, Anderson.
Why do you look at me when you say that?
Because you were on the Grouch News Network.
First you call him a grouch, and then you slander his name.
We need to harness the power of first ladies around the world who are chatting with their husbands. And the power that the conversations that I've had with first ladies around the world, including the one in the United States of America, if we can figure out a way to harness some of their energy and their commitment in words to children, we can indeed make a difference. We need to work together to figure out how to break this political stalemate.
And I see it as a political stalemate.
I do. I think, you know, the fact that this morning I think we heard that 1% of all international aid programs are going to education. The facts, you know, are really about that resources are not going to help children in the world, even though virtually everyone in the world has the same basic needs about bringing up their children so that they can experience a better life than the one they had themselves. We all believe that. It's a basic human value from culture to culture. But it doesn't somehow equate into a political reality once you get it into government. We have to figure out a way, and those of us who are engaged here, and the reason why you're in this room, I think, is we got to come together and figure out some strategies to make that happen and make this real.
I would beg you not to rely on first ladies. I'm sorry to add a dissenting voice, but my experience is that because first ladies are dependent on the election of their husbands and their husbands' change in tenure, that you don't always get the kind of leadership you anticipate. What you really have to depend on are the women activists and the women leaders in the communities on the ground who will do the tremendous job around education that has to be done. But let me tell you, I'm sorry to be unorthodox and perhaps faintly irascible. But the first lady's vehicle, let me tell you, the first lady's vehicle has failed so often in Africa. It is not the way to answer these issues.
It's a global issue, and I guess we've had a different experience, Stephen.
Sure,
so it has worked, and I would urge you to not do, it's not one or the other. I think it's both.
Great. We're going to take a short break for, 30 minutes?
Yeah, that's right. Now we're going to turn it over to the tables once again to discuss our question, which is what are a few things that can be done to address this challenge, by whom and how? So thank you so much to our inspiring panel. This has really been wonderful, and we'll be back after our discussion.